Today is the talk on the last of the five hindrances, which is usually translated into English as doubt. And maybe to tie the morning together with the afternoon, we could sing "This Little Doubt of Mine." I'm gonna let it shine. This little doubt of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. And there's something very wise about letting it shine, and it's partly, and then to take the metaphor of the journey, the route that we're on, you can have doubt about the route, but that when doubt is about, then doubt becomes the route. Meaning that we don't have to be afraid of ourselves and afraid of what's going on in us. It's possible to turn towards everything, allow everything. And in that allowance, in that turning towards, to discover ourselves, discover our freedom, discover our connection actually to the world and to others. But it's a counterintuitive, for many people, a counterintuitive turning, because it often means turning away from business as usual and turning towards something new and a different way of being. So these five hindrances can be seen as unproductive strategies for dealing with challenges. Life often has a lot of challenges, and there's no shortage of them as we go along. And trying to cope with them, these challenges, and respond to them, deal with them, these five hindrances can be different strategies that people take on. So some people, the strategies go in the form of desire, wanting. So, you know, one of the great things to do if you have deep personal angst and insecurity and loneliness and out of sortness and, you know, feeling really bad is to go shopping. That'll do it. What is this about going, you know, on a 7-day retreat when you could just go shopping? Some people, shopping is very, you know, that's an escape sometimes, you know, and a way to deal with it. It's almost like to go away from it. And there's I love this cartoon from many years ago, of a Charlie Brown cartoon where Charlie's talking to Linus, and Charlie says, "Oh, so you don't think my dad knows how to repair cars, fix a car? Well, just the other day we were driving along and there was a loud clanging coming from the engine." And Linus says, "Don't tell me he stopped and fixed it." "No, he turned up the radio." So, you know, so a desire route, so all kinds of things we might want, pleasure, whatever. Sometimes an escape, turning away from what's difficult and what's hard. Getting a substitute for an alternative. And then there's the strategy of aversion, ill will, pushing away, resisting, fighting, and rather than really meeting the challenge and meeting ourselves in the challenge, really kind of being there and being really seeing what it is, sometimes we think we have to fight and we push away and we blame and we judge negatively. And you know, in these years that I've been a teacher, it's fairly common for people to come and talk about their judgmentalism, you know, that they're caught up in judgments, often of other people. And it's fairly common, if you just kind of look a little bit under the judging, that it's often an attempt to try to protect oneself, to try to avoid feeling somehow bad in oneself. Often maybe feeling insecure, being afraid, feeling inadequate, not up to snuff or something. And a great way to feel like you're somebody important, is to have somebody that you can criticize and say, look at them. They don't know what they're up to. They don't know what foot to stand on. And I know, I have 2 feet, and I know. But, you know, those people, look at that, you know. And, you know, and it's obvious you stand on 2 feet and look at that person, you know. And sometimes it's really great to do that with, you know, with a friend. You know, listen, you know, that person with it doesn't know what foot to stand on. And, you know, who let them into this human realm? And it's a way of turning the attention away and trying to bolster ourselves. And so it's a kind of an aversion. It's kind of, you know, a critical thinking that goes on. So we're challenged, and so it's, you know, very uncomfortable. So we get the deflect the discomfort away if we can find someone to blame. Find it out somewhere out there, the problem out there. So another strategy is this, you know, the lethargy, you know, the seer strategy. You know, and you see it sometimes. You see it in babies, and not that babies are doing this strategy, but you see babies sometimes, if they're overstimulated with the environment, sound and stuff, they'll fall asleep. And adults sometimes do that too, especially like you see it in meditation. If things are just too difficult, emotionally difficult, and memories come are difficult, or just self-knowledge is, you know, seldom good news. And so as these things come, you know, it's like, you know, just let's go to sleep. You know, let's just kind of get dull and cloudy and not really be able to see. And it's kind of a way of turning off, maybe, and resisting. So that's another strategy. And then there's a strategy of restlessness. You know, you don't have to deal with anything if you're running around in circles. You know, like you're trying, you know, do this and that and take care of everything. And so sometimes it's a way of avoiding being restless. And even worry sometimes is a strategy of avoiding. Sometimes it's frightening to stop worrying, because then you have to really be open and present for what's going on. And so it's, you know, it's another strategy to avoid. And so then doubt. So doubt can be a strategy as well. With doubt, you don't have to decide. And if you're faced with challenges of a variety of different types, and you know, you don't have to really deal with a challenge if you are confident that you have doubt. If you're sure that you don't know, and you know, as you go left and right, and what should we do? So you have a difficult job interview that day, and you know, should you get out of bed on the left side or out of bed on the right side? And what's the right side to get out of? And well, you don't know, so you might as well just stay in bed. doubt can be a stress. So I think sometimes it's helpful to learn to identify the hindrances when they arise, and then to consider, could this be a strategy? Could this be a way of avoiding something? And what might that be? What's hard about them is that some of these hindrances come with voices of authority. They're true. And so to do that questioning of it, to have doubt, good, healthy doubt about the hindrances, and say, well, how might it not be really a good thing? You know, it's hard to do that when they come with the authority that this is true. It has to be this way. That person really messed up. You know, or that, you know, I know it's a hard day, but I know that the chocolate will make a difference. You know, that's the voice of authority. And, but you know, maybe a little silly to talk about chocolate, but you know, it could be people can spend years with a desire that's going to do it, you know, the voice of authority. If I just go, you know, to school and get a really good degree, and then I'll really have it made. But, you know, maybe you will, but maybe that's also an avoidance, just big desire, big dream about what that's going to do for you. And I've known people who have pursued what look like dreams, and it was in fact a way, it took years, But there wasn't until I had a career and a life that I realized, wait a minute, what am I doing? I've been avoiding myself all this time. It's a way of not really being present for this here. So there is healthy doubt, and it's actually a very important part of life is to have doubt. And I think many people begin something like a Buddhist practice when they start doubting what they were confident in before. And to start questioning whether some of the pursuits, some of the ways of understanding the world, and some of the ways of operating in the world are really worthwhile, really appropriate, really as valuable as we thought they were. And some of those things we can maybe relatively easily point to, and so like, you know, the pursuit of wealth. And the Buddha didn't mind people getting wealthy. It's not like bad to be wealthy. But there's a lot of people I've talked to who have been disillusioned by what they thought their wealth was going to do. And they realized this was a dead end, and they went away from it because it was such a dead end. And then the pursuit of status, the pursuit of security. If, you know, security seems like a reasonable thing. It actually is a good thing to look for security, some safety, some stability in life. It's a healthy thing, but it's possible to overdo it and put all your eggs in that basket. And then when things change, you're kind of lost. And so it's kind of healthy at some point to have some disillusionment with the pursuit of security without finding security in your own heart. There's a cartoon, I think it's a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon of Calvin, I guess he wants to make himself safe for his snow fight. And so he builds a fort, snow fort, and he's inside. And so he's building these really solid walls, and the walls get higher and really high, big, solid walls. And by the time he's finished building the walls, he's yelling, "Help, I'm stuck inside here." I've seen gated communities where I wondered, you know, are they really safe in there? I wouldn't feel safe in there. You know, I think they've lost something. So what other person? And I've known people who've had careers that they get somehow. Some people have great careers, wonderful things, but I've known people who have start having doubt about, is this really going to make me happy? Is this really where happiness is found and well-being is found? And, you know, I guess I just followed it because I was expected to do this route. This is what my parents expected me, what my society expected me to do. But, you know, is this really me? Is this really what my life is about? And then I've known people who've been frightened to make any, begin realizing that, but they're frightened. One man I know, I think in particular, who was clear he didn't like his job, and disillusioned with it and tired of it, and encouraged him for a long time to take the risk and leave his job and find something else, find himself, because he wasn't going to find himself in that work. And it was quite remarkable how he was not going to budge. He was going to, you know, stick it out. He did. He stuck it out until at some point he was able to retire. But it was, you know, I think at a great cost, kind of not really being, I'd like to say true to himself. I don't know if that's accurate, but, you know, a great cost of continued kind of deadening kind of existence going on and on, being unhappy. And then there's disillusionment, or at least maybe not disillusionment, but beginning to doubt some of the strategies we have, or some of the beliefs we have. At some point, I started doubting whether it was really useful or to the pursuit of trying to get everyone to like me, which I thought was, you know, And it took me a while to realize I even had that belief, but I had that belief there subconsciously, and that's I was operating under that. And I felt very fortunate that I was kind of put in charge of the monastery kitchen. We were like sometimes 15 people working, and the monastery kitchen is considered a pressure cooker. And it doesn't work to be head of the kitchen there and have people like you. It just doesn't, the two don't go together. And so I got to see, you know, in my face, this desire that I did and all the social gymnastic I did to try to get everyone to like me. And it might have saved me a little bit, protected me a little bit, because at one point one of my people who worked under me said, "Gil, we have to go outside and talk." So I went outside to talk, and the first thing he said was, "If you weren't so sincere, I'd punch you out." So, you know, so it had its maybe some benefit that I was trying to get people to like me, but it was such a, it was so exhausting, and so I started seeing in the monastery how exhausting it was, and so then I first started questioning, first I saw what I was doing, and then I started questioning it, having doubt, is this really possible or valuable to do? You know, they're trying to control everything, have everything to be just the way I want it to be. Just having doubt about that. And so at some point, what we're doing, how we're living, our beliefs, our attitudes, our desires, our aversions, we start feeling, some people start feeling, this doesn't work. It's not working. I've been doing this for a long time. And so then putting a question mark next to it, after it, wondering, is this really important? Is this really valuable? Is this really what life is about? Is this what I'm about? Is this what I should do? Is there another way? And without some, you know, sooner or later, I think that's, for many people, that's kind of the turning point, very important turning point. And so without doubt, for many people, there's no beginning of a path to freedom. And so we don't want to be very careful not to dismiss the importance of having doubt. But I call this kind of doubt questioning doubt, as opposed to the doubt that's a hindering doubt. And the hindering doubt of the hindrances is that doubt, probably the translation better in English is something like indecision or vacillation. So we're indecisive, we don't know what to do, we can't commit ourselves, we're uncertain what to do, should I, shouldn't I, and we can't decide, is a big part of it. So this inability to commit, inability to step forward, inability to meet the situation because we're vacillating, we're uncertain, we're kind of conflicted or something. And it can take a form of debilitating doubts of all kinds. As a hindrance, doubt as a hindrance for the path of freedom is specifically about doubt about the very path of freedom itself, connected to the path, to the journey. So it's doubting the practice, it's doubting the path, the practice, where it goes, it's doubting the teachings, the teacher, doubting the community you're practicing with, doubting the, is it the right time to practice? Is it the right, you know, circumstance? And, you know, I've done this, and I think maybe some of you have done this. Spend months and months, you know, and happily anticipating going on retreat, happily in a fantasy about how great it was going to be, how it's going to make everything wonderful for me, and it's going to, you know, and it's, don't want to be disappointed and not get in because this is going to do it. And then it gets closer and closer, and so, oh, it feels so good, you know, get to go and sit down and meditate the first day, and I'm not sure this is the right time. And, I'm not sure this was, did I sign up for the right retreat? You know, and yeah, I'm serious about practice, but, you know, these people I'm sitting with, I don't know if I can practice with these people. You know, because and then a subtext, I guess, so the implication would be that you poor person, you can only practice if you get a lot of support from the right people. But, you know, we won't say that. Or you know, so it's doubt about the practice, the whole sphere of what we're doing. And one of the really good ones is doubt about ourselves. Am I up to this? Am I capable of this? And sometimes it's because it just seems like such a big mountain to climb. It's so much to do. Wow, could I ever do that? I can't do it. And then we forget that the mountain is climbed one step at a time. So just one step at a time. And or we realize that, or we just feel like somehow we don't have what it takes. We're inadequate. One of the doubts that was very common for me was I doubted everything about myself. You know, just like that. I doubted myself. I was ever good enough. I doubted whatever was happening to me. Whatever was happening to me, I don't think this is it. I don't think this is quite it. You know, I always measure it, and you know, took out my measuring tape and measured it, and like, is this real? Is this it? You know, and I was, no, this can't be it. Whatever I was, you know, and whoever who I was, whatever I was doing, whatever I was experiencing, you know, this is not it. You know, it can't be it. You know, that doubts about it, and so I could never quite settle because it was always, the grass was always greener somewhere else. Some other experience was it, but this couldn't be it. It was happening to me. If I was doing, it was my understanding. I'm just bumbling along. I don't know, and I don't. It can't be good enough because it's me. And so there's never any settling. And one of the great moments was on retreat, sitting, being fairly quiet and peaceful. And the same thing operating, you know, kind of in the background, I kind of started to see this subtle background operating system that, you know, this is never, whatever's happening in the moment, that's never the right thing. It's never quite it. And I didn't know what it was, but it didn't matter. I just knew it wasn't it. And so at some point, I was calm enough that I kind of saw very clearly that it was kind of like a subtle thought going through, this is not it, something else is it. And I saw that, oh, just a thought. If I stop having that thought, what's it like? Well, if you stop having that thought, everything's good. If I stop having that thought, it's actually peaceful right now. And the only thing that, it was kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's not quite right what's happening. You know, it's not it. I had the evidence of it because I felt off. I felt kind of anxious or kind of a little bit kind of oppressed by it's not it. But the very thing that was oppressing made it off was the very thought, it's not quite it. It's tricky, right? Is it tricky? So I felt very lucky. So that kind of put a question mark behind this attitude. And then I started seeing it more and more and how common it was. The grass is greener. It's never quite it. And what a boogeyman it was for me. And it's very interesting. So this thing, so the kind of the opposite of doubt, I suppose, is confidence. And so one of the interesting question is, what do you have confidence in? So I had a lot of confidence in some of my doubts. I really believed in them. Having doubts is important. Yes, these doubts are everything. I don't know anything, but I'm not sure, uncertain what to do here, but I am certain that I'm uncertain. You know, I'm confident that, you know, because, you know, at least that's what it looks like, because I'm putting a lot of energy with that behind those, the doubts. I'm acting or not acting, choosing how to be because of those doubts. There's a lot of confidence behind it. So what do you have confidence in? What do you have confidence in? Do you have confidence in wanting people to like you? Do you have confidence? Here's a great one to lose confidence in. And that is, do you have confidence in what other people think about you is important? How much do you invest in what other people think about you? I think it's really, really common that maybe it's kind of hardwired into our operating system. Not hardwired, but it's very deep. Maybe we're born this way because we're social animals and we want to fit into our society and find our place in it. And so being tuned in and knowing how other people are seeing us and relating to us and thinking about us has some role, because people can, you know, not always, you know, sometimes be mean. And so it's kind of makes sense that we kind of have our radar up a little bit. But I think this thing about being concerned about what other people think about us in our society is generally overrated. And it's really healthy to kind of see, if it's happening to you, how much the concern would be how other people are seeing us in one form or other. What are people thinking? So how much confidence we have that it's important to be concerned about what other people think, and how confident are we, how much confidence and strength we put behind the idea that it's important that people not judge us. And it would be a disservice to you to say, oh, you know, no one's judging you. Human beings, that's what people do. They judge each other. I mean, it's like, you know. Why do you care that people judge you? I mean, at some point you have to kind of lose confidence that this is important. Let them think what they do. I love this little quote from the Buddha. They'll criticize you if you talk too little. They'll criticize you if you talk too much. They'll criticize you if you talk just in the middle between them. No one in this world is free of criticism. No one in this world is free of criticism. So if having someone think negatively about you is a hook, is so important for you, if you have a lot of confidence that this is a big, important, major issue, that's where you put your confidence in, then, you know, you're going to be bouncing off the walls. You're going to be bouncing off people reacting all the time. But just let it, what about just letting it be? What about just, you know, maybe it doesn't matter what people so much, most of the time. Sometimes it matters a lot. But maybe sometimes it doesn't matter as much what people think. Let it be. Let it be. And meditation is a great place to start putting these question marks behind many things. Because, for example, this thing about what people think about you. When you're sitting and meditating, the eyes are closed, upright, you're in a safe place. No one's speaking to you. No one's really going to do anything to you. Just sitting there, minding your own business. What does it matter then and there what people think about you? Isn't it okay sometimes to drop it? To just sit and just be? To have the freedom not to be caught by that is so powerful. And then sometimes when you need to be concerned what people think about you, sometimes it's important, then you're freer around it. You're not caught in the grip of it, in the vice of it. It's not like dear life or something. So what do you have confidence in that maybe is not serving you? If you looked at your life from a distance, or if an anthropologist from Mars came to study you, didn't know your language that you spoke, so they were just, you know, watching your behavior, what would they think that you had confidence in? Well, for a lot of you, it's probably screens. A lot of confidence in screens. Spend a lot of time looking at screens. What do they see in your behavior and how you think and stuff? What do you have confidence in? What do you really believe in? What do you invest a lot of time and effort and thought into? And then this great thing to start putting question marks behind things. Is it really so? Is this how it is? Is there another way? To begin opening up the space in the mind to be able to look at things in a fresh way, to look anew, to not be always thinking in the usual ways, but put a question, is this so? So the hindering doubt. So doubt, so when we start questioning that what we how we're operating and thinking maybe this doesn't work anymore, one of the first things that can come in is from this healthy doubt and can follow in the wake of it is hindering doubt. You know, feeling fear, feeling indecision, feeling, uncertain. And so that uncertainty, not being able to take a step forward, not knowing what to do. On retreat, doubt can be very, very powerful sometimes and can be quite debilitating. One of the great examples of debilitating doubt was a story that Sylvia Borstein tells of sitting a long retreat at IMS. And then at some point during the retreat, realized that she called up the airlines and got a ticket to leave the retreat and go back to California. And it wasn't until she was on the plane that she realized she was caught in doubt. Well, it was just doubt. So in other words, she gave up the practice, she left the retreat, she got on the plane, she really left, right? Because she had doubts about this is the right time, this, you know, this doubt about the practice, what she was doing. And it's so convincing sometimes that we believe it. But you know, this is, you know, doubt about it, so I'm not going to do it. So what is that kind of doubt, hindering doubt? Is it thoughts and beliefs that we are telling ourselves, stories we're telling ourselves? Is it deeper than that? Is it fears that we have about facing something? Is it an avoidance mechanism? And it could be interesting to ask sometimes when doubt is strong, what are you avoiding? If doubt wasn't there, what would you have to meet and see and be present for? If you do that wonderful turn, 180 degree turn, around of attention, really feel yourself, what would you feel? Sometimes the activity of doubting is a way of not feeling ourselves, what's happening. So what do we feel? What's here? And so this little cliche, you know, that the doubt is the route. Whatever is happening for you is the path. Not that you continue having doubt, but it's a path. If you make it the path by turning towards it and really seeing it. So to really kind of have enough confidence in the mindfulness that you're willing to turn around and be mindful of doubt rather than believing doubt. And so to really feel what doubt is like in the body. Do you feel like a draining of energy? Do you feel a kind of a restlessness because of doubt? Do you feel a kind of sinking feeling with doubt? Do you feel a strong sense of conviction that comes with doubt sometimes? Sylvia had to have a lot of conviction to have gotten the ticket and left. And then what's going on in the mind with the doubt? What's the energy of the mind? What's the speed of your thinking? What's the tone of the thoughts that kind of have doubt as part of them? What's really going on? Turn around and be mindful and explore and feel what's going on there. Then you can try to understand what your doubt needs once you understand it. Sometimes what doubt needs, if you have doubt about the practice, sometimes it's good to get instructions. Sometimes the doubt means you don't quite understand the instructions well enough. And so you want to get it clarified, talk to a teacher. Sometimes the doubt is about, you know, is this the right time to practice? Is the right place? And then to do some, sometimes it's helpful to do some reflection and really think it out. It's just, you've got to step back, maybe even journal about it. And look at, you write it down, and so you can see what you're believing. And then kind of look at it and read it a few times or say it to yourself. One of the great little psychological techniques is to have some belief that's kind of in the background, but maybe quite powerful that you have there in the, about something, like a doubt. And then once you recognize it, say it really, really loud in your mind. Like, the doubt about yourself, so I can't do this. And yell it in your mind, I can't do this. I can't do this. And after a while, it just seems ridiculous. You know, you get some perspective and, you know, or journal or something, and kind of see what you're believing. You know, really kind of feel it and be it and kind of take it in. And that may kind of sometimes break the mystique of it, the allure of it. Sometimes what helps with doubt is more discipline. So if the doubt isn't too strong, and that's why it's very helpful to have a schedule, like sitting, walking, is to be committed to the schedule no matter what. So you don't have to doubt the schedule. What should I do next? I'm not sure, I'm not up for it, I can't do it, it's the wrong time, I'm the wrong person. Nope. You know, yes, I have all those things might be true, but the bell rang, I'm gonna go sit. You know, so there's a sense of discipline, just following through with, like, almost like you have a commitment to do this. And this was very helpful for me because in my early years, because I did Zen training, where the commitment was, I don't know how much commitment it was obligation. You know, you just had to do it, you know, there was no choice but to show up. And so that was a great support for me because all my vacillation, you know, and doubt, like, you know, this is, you know, I can't do it or not do it. I didn't have that choice but to go back to the hall and sit and practice. And with Vipassana, we give a fair amount of permission, which sometimes is useful to do, but it's also the permission sometimes is an easy out for people who are having doubt. But if there's no permission, just gotta go sit, gotta go walk. So you might consider discipline and motivation and just as being helpful. Sometimes it cuts through it. So doubt. And then there's a very peculiar kind of doubt. A peculiar kind of disillusionment. Disillusionment sometimes is closely connected to all this. And a particular doubt about Buddhism, particular doubt or disillusionment with practice. There comes a day and a time where I think, I hope that everyone gets disillusioned in Buddhism. Because you only need to be disillusioned if you're illusioned to begin with. And people will have a tremendous enchantment with Buddhism and think it's so great, the world religion and all this great teachers, the Dalai Lama, and, you know, it's a world religion, so it must have tremendous authority, it must be the truth, and, you know, they have statues and Buddhas and they have buildings and they have books and Bibles and, you know, and it must be, it's so great. And I've heard a number of monastic teachers of monastics, who say that monastic training in Buddhism doesn't really begin until the monk gets disillusioned with monastic life. And it's those who continue who really find the value of it. But to those who give up then, they're right at the juncture of seeing something. And the reason why disillusionment, certain kind of disillusionment is helpful and doubt is helpful here, is that because of the enchantment we have, this is going to do it for me. This is going to solve all my problems. I'll be great. You know, if I just do this great, and I'll be associated with this great religion, and I get to wear a badge, and, you know, and I'll have it made, and I'll go to my high school reunion, and I'll be the Buddhist. Or And also sometimes it's really good to be disillusioned with the practice, because not because practice is not good, it's fantastic practice, but what we invest in it, what we believe it's going to do for us, is not really accurate. It's not really about. So some of you heard the story of a wonderful experience I had early on in my practice that I think really helped me avoid some of the, kind of get disillusioned kind of quickly and early in Buddhism. It's really good to be disillusioned with Buddhism. It saves you a lot of grief. and that was that, I'd been practicing Zen a little bit on and off for a few years, a couple of years, and then I started going to a small sitting group in my college town, and I would go, and by that time I really started sitting. I was sitting twice a day, every day by myself, and twice a week I'd go sit in this little living, little bedroom, spare bedroom that in an apartment that a couple had, and there were, I don't know how many, three, four, five of us would come together to meditate, do Zazen, Zen meditation. It's a very small little room, and so it was small enough that, and in Zen you sit facing the wall, with the eyes open, and so the wall was just at the edge of my knees, and I was sitting up against the wall. And so then suddenly, in front of me there arose this great big Roman column, majestic, kind of like the columns in front of a bank that tell you the bank is authoritative and. So this column arose, and written, engraved in the column, and painted black, were these letters Z-E-N. And so I don't know where the hallucination stopped and where reality came in, but what happened next was that I went like this to embrace the column. And as I embraced it, the column disappeared, and I fell forward and hit my head against the wall. So, as I was going home that day, I reflected on that experience. That got my attention. I'm not prone to hallucinations. That was kind of like a new thing for me. So I realized that I had made Zen, Buddhism, Zen, this big, you know, external religion. And, you know, this big authority thing. And I was going to study Zen. I was going to get Zen. Zen was out there, and I was going to acquire it, get it, have it, be it, or something. And it just vanished. And I thought, maybe there is no Zen. Maybe Zen, that's not the point, to get Zen. Maybe the point is to go the other direction and go in and really see what's here. And so that's where one of the times in my life where I began this turn inward to sit with myself, to be here and sit here, be centered here. I can be the column. I can be the authority and be here and discover what was here. And there was a lesson I had to learn a few different times when I went to Japan, practiced a monastery there. At some point, the monastery I was practicing in, I was committed to stay there for 5 months for a retreat. But at some point, I realized this is not the right place for me. It was pretty clear to me it was not the right place. I think it was healthy understanding. It wasn't like I was running away from it. But I invested so much authority in Zen and the monastery and the abbot. And it was a very special moment for me when I decided I know what I need to do, and I will do what I need to do, and not be cowered by this the great authority of Zen Buddhism and all that. So that was a great moment of kind of being true to myself. And what was interesting was once I made that decision that I could make that decision, I knew what I needed to do. Then I actually, in my own free will, decided to stay. And the only reason I decided to stay was that there was a Japanese monk who had vouched for me to be at the monastery. And if I had left, it would be really bad for his reputation in Japan. And I didn't want him to get hurt by me. So So then it was okay. Then I was fine with staying, and it was a nice experience overall in some ways. But it confirmed, even staying the next 2 months, it confirmed that I was right. I shouldn't have been there. You know, so sometimes it's helpful to get disillusioned with teachers, disillusioned with practices, disillusioned with the teachings, disillusioned with Buddhism. Not to walk away, not to have doubt and just go to the next thing, you know. Because if you give up this path and say you decide to go do Sufism or do some, you know, go to Christianity or something, chances are you'll come to the same juncture at some point. And I've heard stories of people who just, you know, when they come up against times when it's difficult, they just go to the next religion. Right? And it's always looking externally. Sooner or later, the movement is here. So the Zen master Dogen, he has this great teaching. He said, to study Buddhism is to study the self. But then he goes on and says, to study the self is to forget the self. That's nice. But then he says something even more wonderful. He said, to forget the self is to be confirmed, to be acknowledged by all things. Some people translate it as to be intimate with all things, but the actual expression is to be confirmed with all things. If you confirm yourself, then maybe it's just more self. But if you allow reality to show you who you are, maybe then you'll really discover who you are. So, to sit, to have doubt, to question your doubts, to get disillusioned with some of the beliefs that you have. Not so much to leave you, not to leave you bereft, but to leave you with yourself. To leave you with yourself in a really simple way. To allow yourself just to be. That you don't have to prove yourself to anybody. You don't have to apologize to anybody. You don't have to become something great. You don't have to see yourself as less than anybody. It's okay just to sit quietly and breathe easily. It's okay to let all the fantasies and thoughts about the past and the future, let them subside. Rather than having all your problems solved, it's okay to let them dissolve. To sit and let things, the hardness and the preoccupations of your mind and your heart, to let them dissolve, to let them thaw. To meet yourself and open to what's here and learn with whatever is what's here, to learn to be at rest here. To have confidence in your feet on the floor as you stand. You're here. To have confidence with your butt on the cushion, here. To have confidence that you're a breathing person, just breathing, here. To have confidence in just hearing a sound and letting it be just a sound. To have confidence that it's okay to let a thought just arise and pass. To have confidence it's okay to feel what you're feeling as just a feeling. Keep it simple. To just be. to be, I like the word simple, but maybe that sounds like simpleton, but just it's okay to just to be alive is enough. Sit here quietly and breathe to be at peace. The story I said earlier of I was well, you know, had some peace, and the only thing that was jarring my peace was the thought that I wasn't good enough. This wasn't good enough. And to let that go, just be here. To not be chasing after rainbows when you can just come back here. Be here. So the disillusionment that is important is the one that helps you finally come home. Finally come home and be at home in yourself. And as the practice matures, one of the ways I like to think of the maturing of this practice is your heart is at home in itself. Your heart comes to, your heart is at rest in itself. The heart is at home in itself. And then, when you're simple, or just at ease, just be. Don't have these overlays of shoulds and shouldn'ts and judgments and ideas. But you learn the art of really coming here and just being here, being your own column, being rooted and present, realizing that you're important, you have value. Just be. Not be simple just as someone who has no value, but be simple as complete value. Total value, just here, breathing. Then there's a wonderful next step. So in this journey from questioning the ways of living our lives that doesn't quite work, to then looking deeply, exploring it, coming to oneself, being mindful, working through the doubts and the disillusionments, and coming to the other side, and starting to have some semblance of being at rest and at peace in this world, in this life, and just breathing and being here. And then there's the return to the world. Someone once said, these Buddhists, all they ever talk about is practice, practice, practice. When, I want to know, when's the performance? And I think there's something to this issue because, and this is where there are some schools of Buddhism that actually focus more on, not so much on letting go, not so much on just being mindful and seeing there and accepting what's there and all that, but rather, it's how you are in the world, how you manifest yourself, the performance of what you do. So you might sit and meditate, but then whatever you are, how you are, your freedom that you discover, then it doesn't really matter unless you perform it, you act it. So if the monastery is dirty, you sweep it, you clean it. If you leave the monastery and the rest of the world is dirty, you clean it. You meet it, you engage, you bring yourself, you allow what's inside of you to come out. And there's something beautiful about allowing what's within you deep inside to be expressed, the performance, that it doesn't come through the filter of I'm not good enough, or people, I want people to like me, or I should be doing this. You know, or maybe then I'll get a better ego, I'll get a better self, all this kind of, something which doesn't come out of greed, hate, and delusion, doesn't come out of self-centeredness, but comes out of something that's deeper inside of us than any place that we can call self-centered. So to allow it to come and manifest. It's not just about sitting quiet, but it's also about letting something flow. And it may be something that can't really be premeditated, but something that you feel and are in touch with, that comes when you breathe easily, when you're at ease and at home and settled. What is it in there that wants to come forth? What wants to come out of you when you are deeply connected to yourself and not limited by the hindrances, not limited by fear, not limited by needing to be good, not limited by so many of the voices of family and society about what you can and can't do. So that's the, we leave with Ruth called the marketplace. Make this journey, discover that the hindrances are the path. Be willing to face them, meet them, be with them. The path is through them to being able to come into a place, time and place, where we can breathe with ease. Our breath can be free. Our heart can be at ease and free. And then it's curious to find out what comes from us then, what comes out of us. So maybe that's what Ruth was singing about this morning. This little heart of ours. Let it shine. So let it shine. So let's do this journey again and again and again. Over and over again we'll take this journey. So let's sit quietly. And as you sit quietly for a few moments, perhaps you can be your great Roman column for yourself. Feel the substance, the weight, the solidity of your body. And feel contact against the chair or your cushion. Feel your torso arise up towards the sky. And perhaps have confidence, enough confidence that it's okay for a few moments just to be here, breathing. Or have enough confidence that it's okay to meet yourself, to discover yourself as you are, here, now.